You guys, Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books was nominated for a Webby Award, which is this really prestigious award that I am dying to win. And there's a People's Voice component, and you can vote and get me from number two, second place, to first place. But you have to vote. Please go to vote.webbys.com. Vote.webbys.com, but it's kind of complicated, so it might be easier just to go to zibbyowens.com or my Instagram at zibbyowens, where it'll always be in my stories and it's in one of those little circle highlights. Please, please, please vote. Voting ends April 18th and I'm in second place, so please vote for best individual episode, talk show, interview show. Thank you so much.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, I'm Zibby Owens, and you're listening to the award-winning podcast, Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. If you like this podcast, you will love my new anthology called Moms Don't Have Time to Have Kids. Check it out, and you'll hear from 49 authors about all sorts of things moms don't have time to do. All the authors have been on this podcast. Also, check out my TikTok, at With Zibby and Tracy, my other podcast, Sex Talk with Zibby and Tracy. Check out Moms Don't Have Time to Write on Medium. And of course, my new publishing company called Zibby Books. And now back to our daily author interview site and a quick hello from some of my kids.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello. Enjoy the show. Happy New Year, everyone. I hope you all had a great break. I wanted to let you know about something that I've been talking a lot about on social media at Zibby Owens, which is the hashtag 22in22 challenge. We are at Zibby Books. We are encouraging everybody, like all of you, to visit 22 bookstores in 2022. And we're going to provide a whole series of incentives for every 5 visits, and you'll be entered to win a $500 shopping spree, and you'll get fun things like bookmarks and all the rest. Plus, you'll be part of a great community of people all helping support bookstores, authors, and more. We're really, really excited about it. If you want to join, sign up. You just go to 22in22.net. That's 22in22.net and click I'm in and put your information. And then every time you go to a bookstore, you just quickly go back on the site and click log a bookstore visit. And then we'll be keeping track and we'll be following up with all of your different achievements and awards and everything. So please sign up, spread the word. 22in22, get your friends to join and start visiting bookstores, and it'll be really fun and exciting. So here's to a wonderful 2022. I'm so excited that you're listening to my podcast and doing all the fun things that I have been trying to bring into the world. So here we go, 2022, hashtag 22in22. Erica C. Barnett is the author of Quitter, a memoir of drinking, relapse, and recovery. And I definitely talked a bit too much about myself in this episode, so forgive me. Erica C. Barnett is an award-winning political reporter. She started her career at the Texas Observer and went on to work as a reporter and news editor for the Austin Chronicle, Seattle Weekly, and The Stranger. She now covers addiction, housing, poverty, and drug policy at her blog, The C is for Crank. She has written for a variety of local and national publications, including The Huffington Post, Seattle Magazine, and Grist. Welcome, Erica. Thanks so much for coming on Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Okay, your memoir. Let's discuss. Quitter. Tell listeners what your memoir is about. The full subtitle, because I'm afraid I'm going to get it wrong because I don't have it in front of me. Now that I've been displaced into this other room. tell us everything.
Sure. Yeah. It's called Quitter, a memoir of drinking, relapse, and recovery. And it's sort of in the tradition of Quitlet, which is, you know, the genre of books that are about quitting, in my case, alcohol. I quit drinking a little under 7 years ago as we're recording this. And, but the book is really primarily about my experience of relapse in the process of recovery and the process of trying to quit drinking. I wrote it, you know, because as I was trying to get sober and as I was, you know, failing and failing again and again, and I became really, really obsessed with reading Quitlet books. There's tons of great books out there. A friend of mine, Sarah Heppala, wrote a book called Blackout. There's just, you know, any number of books by women. Carolyn Knapp's Drinking a Love Story is a classic.
It's like one of my favorite books of all time.
Yeah. And so I read those obsessively over and over and over again. And just thinking like, why can't I get it? Why can't I get it? These women got it. And I read a lot of men's books too, and sort of related to those stories a little more because they were a little more in line with the way that I drank, which is constantly from the second I woke up to the second I passed out at night. But the thing that I sort of noticed in the vast majority of those books is they didn't talk about relapse. They talked about sort of getting worse and drinking more and hitting rock bottom and something really, you know, usually pretty dramatic happening, not in all cases, but something happened where they just said, I'm done. And then they were done. And I didn't understand why that didn't happen for me, since that's the story and that's what's supposed to happen. And then, you know, I started trying to get sober. I started getting a little more serious about it and going to AA meetings, to other types of, you know, group meetings, to therapy, you know, all these different things that I describe in the book. And I realized that actually, you know, just anecdotally, and as it turns out, you know, in reality, most people actually do relapse at least once and often quite a number of times before they finally are able to quit or reduce their drinking or whatever, you know, sort of recovery looks like for them. And, you know, that gave me a lot of hope because it made me realize that I wasn't failing every single time that I, you know, quote unquote, failed to stop drinking and picked up again. And I really wanted to, so getting back to the memoir, I really wanted to tell that story because for me, you know, if I had known that it was actually normal and that I wasn't insane and that I wasn't just an utter failure, I think it might have been a little easier for me and it wouldn't have taken as many years because it took about 6 years of pretty solidly trying before I finally was able to quit in February of 2015.
Wow. Well, the way you write about it is so really just you're in it with you, right? You're in the moment, you're in the liquor store, you're in your office, like packing up. I mean, that scene that you, when you, the people tried, your coworkers tried to get you into treatment and then you went, but it was not successful. And you showed back up to get your belongings and, you know, the people who you thought were your allies were not, which often happens in all of these types of stories, right? People have a limit that they're willing to like sort of go to. But I have to say, like, as you're going home and waking up and bleeding and, you know, all this stuff, like I was in it every second. Like you just take the reader right in. You're a really great writer. I guess I should have just said that. You're a great writer. There.
Thank you. Well, I mean, and I think like, you know, one response that I've gotten, which has been, you know, to me, it's actually a great compliment, even if people don't always mean it this way, is that I come across as really unlikable in the book. And I think, you know, and people tell me that, and I get, you know, people saying, you know, I really can't sympathize with this person because of course, like I read the Amazon reviews because I am, you know, an online person, and I just can't, I'm on Twitter all the time. I can't help but see, you know, how people are reacting. And when people say that, I mean, that was my intent. I was really unlikable, and most people didn't like me, you know? And I mean, even my best friend couldn't stand me. And so, and my parents couldn't stand me, and nobody could stand me because I was like, I was becoming an unlikable person, or I was an unlikable person. And, you know, when I read back and sort of even think about it now, first of all, it's a long time ago at this point, and it feels like a different person living a different life, quite frankly. Like when I read about that, I'm like, who the hell is this girl? You know? And second, you know, I don't like that person, and I'm frustrated with her. And I'm like, well, girl, why can't you get it? Because, you know, when you're sort of on the outside looking in at addiction or just at any sort of compulsive behavior that someone is engaging with that's maladaptive, you're like, why don't you just stop doing that thing that's maladaptive and do the thing that is, you know, better for you? And that is the nature of addiction. I mean, it's, you know, or any, you know, sort of mental illness, it's not entirely within your control. I mean, ultimately, you are the only person who can sort of take the steps that are necessary to pull yourself out of that. But it's just, it's not as simple as stop doing the bad thing and do the good thing.
I mean, I feel like I have, not to compare, whatever, like I have the same thing with eating. You know, it's so much easier people saying I have a drinking problem. I feel like I have an eating problem. Like I'm just, you know, something I struggled with my entire life and I just like can't get a handle on it. And I keep trying new things, like what you're saying, like you try to quit and try to like, no sugar and no this, you know, it's a whole like diet culture really, but it haunts you. Cause I'm like, look at everybody else. They don't have a problem. Look at them. They're like, obviously not struggling with their eating. And why am I struggling? And how old do I have to get before this freaking ends? Do you know what I mean? I'm already 45 years old. So anyway, I understand sort of this having this issue that like, you know, not to compare your alcoholism and whatever, but just
no,
that,
I
just
think that they're very comparable. I mean, I do, the reason I say like addiction or a compulsion or like a mental disorder or a, you know, maladaptive behavior, I do think they're all the same. And I think there's addictions. I mean, there are all different kinds of addictions and there's behavioral addictions too, that aren't like, you know, chemical necessarily to the extent that alcoholism is or, you know, or a heroin addiction is. But man, I mean, I talk in the book about like from the time I was, I don't know, I don't think I spell this out this explicitly, but I think I was like 8 when I started exercising with my mom. And, you know, and like paying attention to what I ate and, you know, and even now, like if you look, I mean, I've tried to sort of channel that behavior into more productive areas of my life. But like, you know, I own a business. My New Year's resolution is to not work on Saturdays this year. Not Sundays, because I'm going to keep working on Sundays. I'm going to keep working 6 days a week, you know, but like I have like, you know, to-do lists every day. And I'm just like meticulous about that stuff. And like, it's all the same behavior. You know, I think like sort of being a quote unquote control freak can play into being an alcoholic. It can play into having an eating disorder. You know, it can play into like wanting to work a minimum of 60, 70 hours a week. I think they're all the same kind of behavioral compulsions. And I'm saying this is just based on my own experience and observation. I'm not a scientist, but This is just, you know, what I've observed in my own behavior and then the many, many, many people I've met in recovery who, you know, have to kind of fight against other kind of addictions. I mean, gambling addiction, mm-hmm. again, anecdotally seems really common as a secondary addiction among people who've quit drinking or doing drugs. You know, look at people who smoke compulsively. You know, a lot of people start smoking in rehab. So it's I think it's all kind of comes from this the same impulse toward control, although, of course, like paradoxically with addiction, you lose all control ultimately.
Totally. Wow. I feel like now I'm going to have a little bit of therapy here. This is like introspection to anybody who struggles with stuff. Yeah, I know. I think that's the hardest part too for people who like to control. And by the way, like my New Year's resolution was not to work before 9, right?
Because
usually,
wow. See, exactly.
I'm like, I mean, blushing as thing. I say this, like, I'm not going to work before I drop the kids at school. Like I'm not going to post. I'm not going to check email except for like the school, you know, and even that's been hard.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes those things work. Like I just let, last year, my New Year's resolution was I'm not going to look at Twitter for more than 5 minutes a day. And I actually stuck to that, which was really hard for me because I was getting a little compulsive about it. And I just realized, like, this is just feeding, like, negative energy into my brain first thing in the morning every single day. So, you know, it's I think it's achievable. No work before 9 is achievable, and me not working on Saturday is achievable. We can do it.
Yeah. Saturday, I don't know. I know, have you read Tiffany Schlain's book called 24/6? It's all about taking a tech Shabbat. So her whole family, they apply sort of the wisdom of the Jewish tradition of Shabbat to technology. And so every Saturday, starting Friday night till Saturday sundown, nobody in the family uses technology at all. So, which obviously cuts out.
That's amazing.
And she says she's been doing it for, I don't know, 10 years now, something crazy. And it's like the best part of their week and everything. And I've talked to her many times about this at this point. And every time I talk to her, I'm like, I'm going to try it. I'm going to do it. And, you know, it's really hard. I don't know who's worse at this point, the kids or me, but it's hard. Well, do you think anxiety plays a role with, do you think there's like sort of comorbidity in that? What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I talk in the book about, you know, sort of having this incredibly anxious personality from the time I was very, very young. I had insomnia from the time I was about, you know, 7 or 8 years old. I'm an only child. And I think that, you know, my family really piled onto me this notion that, and I think, you know, mostly to the good, but this idea that like I was going to be a super achiever. You know, my grandparents, my granddad was the first in my family to go to college. My grandmother did not go to college and both my parents did. But like the expectation was like, you're going to go to medical school, you know, or you're going to do something amazing with your life, whatever it is, and you're going to get straight A's and, you know, on and on and on. And so I was sort of primed to be a super achiever. And that causes a lot of anxiety. And I started drinking, I think, you know, to sort of deal with social anxiety, which I think is really common just among people in general. But, you know, it just became sort of a tool for, you know, I don't even want to say a crutch because it was a tool for dealing with anxiety of every kind. You know, it's alcohol is a depressant. It kind of shuts down some of your higher cognitive functions, including the sort of hamster wheel in your brain, or at least there's a hamster wheel in my brain that is just constantly reminding me of like everything I'm not doing. Yeah. Like at every moment, you know, and like it's, you're not doing this, you're not doing this, you're not doing enough, you're disappointing this person, you didn't respond to this email. And so it's, you know, it's a tool, or it was a tool for me to kind of shut that up for a little while. Ultimately, as I said, it's a very maladaptive tool for me personally, and there are lots of better ways. You know, I got really into cognitive behavioral therapy, which I think is just an amazing tool for people with anxiety, who, especially those who also like to write. But yeah, it's, you know, anxiety and addiction, I think, go hand in hand just as much as like depression and addiction do.
I want to do a survey of authors to find out what percent have anxiety issues. Cause I really feel like it's like 90%. I feel like there's also something with writing through it too, which helps the anxiety, or sort of setting it to paper, or I don't know.
Yeah.
I just keep finding this over and over again, the same sort of themes and struggles and all of that.
Yeah, I would say I'm not one of those writers who loves to write. I love having written, you know, and it's kind of like, I discovered this when I started during the pandemic. I started running in part to, you know, deal with stress, and in part because I couldn't go to the gym. And it was kind of the same thing. Like I hate running, and I kind of hate writing. And I just, in my professional life, I'm a political writer, and I, you know, I'm a reporter and cover local news and politics. And I love the feeling of being done with something. It's the greatest feeling in the world. But the process of writing it, I mean, you know, 80% of the time kind of sucks. So it's the feeling of like, oh my gosh, I did that and it's done. And now I can put it out in the world and I don't have to, you know, it's not going to burden me anymore. I think that's how I write through anxiety.
Do you put things on a to-do list that you've done just so you can cross them out?
Yes. And you know, it's funny, when I was first getting sober, I mean, I don't know, maybe this is not funny, but sad. I kind of can't tell the difference anymore, but like, When I was first just kind of coming out of the last place that I went, which was a detox facility, and like, and just trying to even sort of deal with thinking about the wreckage of my life, you know, I had tens of thousands of dollars in debt. I had tons of people who I needed to, you know, apologize to and make amends to. Nobody trusted me, you know, and I didn't have a job. I didn't know how to get a job. You know, my rent wasn't paid. I would do to-do lists that were like brush teeth. you know, take a shower, go outside and get the mail, you know, and it really started from there, just kind of feeling like, okay, I'm doing the basics of my life. And now, of course, like, it's spun out into just, like, today I wrote down prep for this podcast, and I was like, yep, I already did that yesterday. Check.
I do that, too. That's why I asked. Yeah.
So I can see that list getting smaller, and it gives me, like, that little dopamine rush of, like, I'm actually doing things. I mean, yeah, it's definitely, I think it's a pretty healthy coping mechanism for anxiety, but, you know, I don't know what my therapist would say about that.
Sounds like you have a pretty good therapist.
I do, actually.
Yeah. You should get her on. I should do it like a sideshow of like all the writers and
authors, therapists.
Oh my gosh. I mean, they wouldn't be able to say anything, but it would be so funny. Maybe one special episode or something.
Yeah.
Like that. Oh my gosh. So what was it like then sort of reliving these moments, especially the unsavory ones that, like, you know, you didn't feel as proud of, and when you felt your most unlikable and sort of vulnerable, that what was it like sort of writing through it? And then now that it's out, like, do you have any regrets or do you feel exposed? I know you're talking about people who don't like it, which, you know, you can't please everybody. And, you know,
yeah,
I don't buy into that. Like, forget it. They're not your people. That's okay. You know,
but. Still losing it.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Today's episode has been sponsored by Jay McLaughlin. Jay McLaughlin is a timeless lifestyle brand with incredible style and a spirit of connection. I am obsessed with Jay McLaughlin and have been so honored that they are sponsoring my Zibbyverse tour. It just so happens that the tour goes to so many communities and areas of the country that have Jay McLaughlin stores. And I love that the brand is philanthropic through Jay McLaughlin's local and loyal programming. Host store events to give back to organizations that are meaningful to Jay McLaughlin's local communities. I also love the fact that the clothes are just so chic. They make me feel polished and modern. And the best part is that most of the line comes in fabrics that don't wrinkle. I especially love the dresses, the cashmere sweaters, the other sweaters. You'll see them all over my Instagram. I typically tag at Jay McLaughlin. And so you can check it out. It is absolutely one of my favorite brands, and I am over the moon excited to be working with them. In fact, I want to share the love with all of you. Jay McLaughlin is giving 20% off new customers and listeners of my podcast with special code ZIBBY20. Capital ZIBBY 20. That's 20% off for new customers and listeners of the podcast with special code capital Z Zibby 20. Take advantage of it today. My favorites are this white, open, long cashmere sweater that I've been wearing on every flight that I've taken on this tour. I have a blue with light blue horizontal striped sweater, several dresses I even wore on Good Morning America. Check it out, Jay McLaughlin. Thanks so much. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. So sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus and Apple Podcasts.
I don't have any regrets. I mean, the thing about writing through it is, you know, I don't think I could have written it right after I, you know, right as I was coming out of the whole story. And it, I mean, not that the story is over, but right as I was sort of coming out of the part that I write about in the book, I wasn't ready, and I had to process it, and I had to do all that, you know, all those amends to people, and sort of like paying back my debts and just taking care of life, you know, getting a job, getting a new apartment. I mean, all those things that were really hard in the moment. And once I had done that, and once I had kind of processed it, and, you know, I went to a lot of AA meetings, which is like nothing but, I mean, it's basically cognitive behavioral therapy by non-professionals over a very long period of time where you repeat the same stories over and over again. And like, once just to sort in sort of telling your story in that context, it loses its power to hurt you, I think. And so by the time I wrote the book, I felt pretty comfortable talking about it. And I was sort of not dissociated from it, but I was distant enough that I could be a little dispassionate. And then I don't have any regrets about the way that I wrote about it. I guess the only thing about writing a memoir about kind of what I've learned from my experience is that, you know, once you've written it, it's done. And I've continued to learn. And I've actually continued to sort of change my thinking about addiction and about, you know, my own experience and the people in my life and how they reacted. And, you know, so life goes on and you evolve and you have different perspectives on things based on your experience. And yet, you know, it's all just kind of set in stone in this one moment when you, you know, sent the book off to your publisher. So that's just sort of the nature of memoir. Maybe I should write another one, but I'm proud of, you know, the way that I set out the story. There was, you know, you mentioned the people at my work who I thought were my allies. It's one of those people. I actually do think that the people who were at my work and who I talk about, I think in the very first scene of the first chapter, taking me to rehab and then when I got back, firing me or sort of orchestrating my firing, I think they actually were my allies, just not in the way that I wanted them to be at the moment. And I was contacted by one of the people, one of the two women, publisher of the magazine where I worked that I got fired from. And she was really mad at me. And, you know, she was like, you really make me look horrible. And it's like I was trying to help you. And so I do sort of regret that, you know, if anybody read it that way, because I was sort of trying to paint myself as the villain in that scenario and in a lot of the scenarios in the book, because my behavior, you know, I want people to come away thinking that, you know, I was a hard person to like. And so to the extent that, like, that people would read it and think and sympathize with my point of view, when it's a distorted sort of addiction oriented point of view, you know, I don't want people to come away with that impression, but I can't really control that either.
What I say to my kids is it's not that people don't like you, or it's not that I don't like you. It's that it's your behavior, right? So right. Your behavior may have been unlikable, but that doesn't mean people totally gave up on you. I mean, did they?
No, I mean, that's kind of the amazing thing. I mean, one of the things they say in AA all the time that I, you know, I don't think is a very good bit of blanket advice is, you know, you're going to have to get all new friends and, you know, and get rid of everybody from your old life. And, you know, in certain circumstances, you know, and maybe like when AA was being founded in the 1930s, you know, around men who would go out and drink with each other, like maybe that was true. But one of the amazing things about my story is that every single person who was there with me at the beginning of it, when I, you know, when I sort of first started going down that path of addiction, they all came back and they're all still here. I mean, a lot of them didn't go away. You know, my best friend, Josh, who was kind of, you know, I was telling him the other day, he said, oh, I just read the section about me again. And I was like, what are you talking about? The whole book is about you. He never left. I mean, you know, he got very, very frustrated with me. But, you know, I mean, he's still my best friend. And so I was very, very lucky. And I also was very determined to sort of mend those relationships. I mean, it takes a lot of work. But yeah, I mean, I, you know, despite having kind of a dramatic story, I was really lucky at the kind of end of the book and still have all my great friends. And we have much stronger relationships, too, because they're based in, you know, a foundation of a lot more honesty.
Are you afraid now that you've have this whole book that came out and have sort of said that you're like in a good place? Like, are you afraid secretly that maybe you're going to relapse again? And what would happen then? Like, do you fear that?
I mean, you know, it's, I think I did at first because I thought, oh my gosh, like I'm jinxing right, things yeah. by putting this out in the world. But I think, you know, I mean, first of all, if I relapse, it's not going to be because I said that I am a person who relapses. You know, I'm just sort of thinking, I'm talking back to my own like sort of self-talk, which is like, oh no, you said things are good, so things are going to be bad, because that's how my self-talk works. But I think, you know, I think if I relapse, which at this point, you know, I'm 7 years in, you're considered to be in remission after about 5 years. So the odds of drinking now are about the same as somebody who has never taken a drink before. Now, I'm not saying that that is, those are just statistics. It has, you know, nothing to do with me in particular, but I think I have tools, and I think like I know what to do, and I think I know what steps I would need to take at that point. Sort of learning that relapse isn't the end of most people's story, and that, you know, you can actually recover after relapse, I think gives me a lot more confidence in the fact that if I do relapse, that isn't necessarily, you know, the end of the story or the worst thing that's ever happened to anybody, which is definitely what I thought when I was trying to quit and relapsing. You know, I felt like a failure. And in fact, I was typical.
Well, I think, you know, the journey, so to speak, is never over for really anybody. And if it's not that, you know, it's, I think you're so right. It's just sort of managing the impetus for all of that behavior, right? Managing what comes underneath, or managing the temptation, or managing, I don't know, something deeper than just the behavioral part of it.
Yeah. I mean, it's like anything. I mean, like we're talking about, you know, eating disorders or compulsions or, you know, gambling addiction or anything. I mean, you just have to keep trying. Because, I mean, it's not like if I work on a Saturday or if I do something that I said that I was not going to do, I'm just like, okay, well, I guess I just work on Saturdays now. I mean, you know, of course not. I sort of say, okay, that was a setback, and I try to respond to it in, you know, in the way that I know how. And, you know, at this point, I mean, I talk in the book about all the many, many things that I tried. And I think that all of them were effective in some way. I think AA was probably the most helpful for me, just because I'm a person who really kind of needed that structure and needed to be able to talk to people, because I was really isolated. So I think that, like, you know, once you know the tools, you can go back to the tools. And that's true for addiction, and it's true for, you know, any number of behaviors. And so that's what I would hope that I would do. I mean, and that's what I encourage people to do when, you know, I get contacted by people from all over the world and certainly all over the country, you know, saying, hey, you know, I read your book and I'm struggling and I keep relapsing. And it's like, you know, the only advice I can give is like, you're not a failure. Just keep going back to the tools that you know, and keep going back to the tools that worked for you the first time, and they will work again. You just have to keep trying.
Yeah. It's that black and white thinking, right? Mm-hmm. Like, even I've been trying to go on this new health kick or whatever to be healthy. And anyway, I like was with my mother who, well, we won't go, that's like a whole nother podcast. But anyway, we were together over New Year's and I started eating this piece of cake, and I was like, it's okay, I'm going to allow myself like 2 treats a week or whatever. And I started eating the cake, and then of course I couldn't stop because the sugar was like, whoosh, you know? So then I started eating. And then next thing you know, I'm like eating off someone else's plate. And next thing you know, I'm like, don't, that's like halfway in the garbage, you know? And I'm like, well, I'll just finish that scrap in the garbage. Well, you know, and then I said to my mom, I was like, I've ruined it. Like, it's over again. I thought this time it would work. And she's like, it's never going to be over or not over. This is your life. Like, it's just a day. It's just a meal. Like, you pick up it, tomorrow's another day. Like, don't worry about it. And I feel like that voice, like, it would be nice if we all could have that voice in our own heads, right?
Yeah.
We're all so harsh on ourselves for the tiniest missteps. I mean, I'm massively, you know, extrapolating here, which I probably shouldn't, but, you know, it seems very black or white. I've relapsed, I haven't. And maybe in alcoholism, it is more black and white, but, or maybe one drink instead of, you know, maybe I'll be okay with just this, or maybe, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, and like for me, you know, I'm a person that I, the way that I historically drink, and I think would continue to drink, is I can't have just one drink, but I probably could tell myself that. And, you know, and then I think I would sort of be on the spiral. But I also think that, like, there's a spectrum of relapse, and you know, some people refer to it as a slip, like when you just have one drink and then you are like, whoa, I can't be doing that, and tomorrow's another day and you start over. I think that there is sort of all or nothing thinking among some circles in the recovery world, where like you go back to day zero and you start all over, and that's, you know, like you've done it now. Like you have to, you may have had 10 and a half years, but now you're back at day zero and you're crawling back. And I think that's really, really not helpful and counterproductive, and it keeps people away. So I kind of prefer to encourage people and to encourage myself to be, you know, gentle on myself. Cause like, I wouldn't talk the way that I talk to myself, you know, to a friend. I mean, ever. Yeah, I wouldn't have any friends, you know. So I think that's a really important thing that, you know, I try to kind of, you know, when people ask me, and they do ask me a fair amount, you know, it's just to be gentle on yourself with whatever it is that you're trying to change in your life, because, you know, it's not a sprint.
Very true. And I don't know if this applies or not for me when I'm trying to like just be more mindful of food and not wanting to eat dessert like every second, you know, I'm like, okay, this is a craving. This is a feeling. Like, this is a feeling that is going to pass, and I'm going to ride out this feeling, and I'm going to walk in the other room, and like slowly it's going to go away, and it's not going to be as hard.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like acknowledging, and it's like, yeah, feelings are one thing. They're like one piece of your brain. Anyway, I'm sorry. I'm talking about myself so much. I really apologize.
That's okay. I think it's all related. And like, and I think, I mean, this is, it's funny. Like I actually, you know, sometimes I mentioned that AA is a lot like cognitive behavioral therapy. And like, I, you learn the 12 steps in AA and you sort of, you do what's called working a program, which is, you know, you sort of try to apply tools that you've learned to like every part of your life. And I often sort of say that to friends who are not in recovery and who don't, you know, necessarily have the addictive type issues, you know, I feel bad for you that you don't have a program, because having those tools is so useful. And like, whether it comes from therapy or a recovery group or whatever, it is so useful to be able to just kind of talk back to your thoughts in that way. And that's one of the things that we learn, you know, in recovery circles, is like, this is, you know, like you said, this is just a feeling, this will pass, live for today, you know, one day at a time, et cetera, all those cliches. And I talk in the book about how they are really annoying at first, and then something changes and they start to seem like wisdom. I think about that stuff all the time, you know, to this day. I mean, I think, you know, this too shall pass. You know, one day at a time, all that stuff that just seems so stupid and like a dumb little slogan on a wall. Like it is incredibly useful in the moment.
I agree. Very true. Okay. Well, having written a memoir, even though you don't like to write, what advice would you give to aspiring authors?
You know, I think that the reason I was able to write this particular memoir, you know, I'd never written a book before, is because I had an idea of what I wanted it to be and what I wanted to say. I think that if you're going to be like, I mean, in very practical terms, if you're going to be pitching a book, I think outlining it is really an important, you know, an important first step. And I sat down and I wrote an outline and I wrote a pitch and I did the whole thing like in a weekend. And I'm not, you know, again, this is like my sort of compulsive work behavior. I wrote 50 pages in a weekend. I don't recommend doing that. But I think, you know, it's really important to have a theme and an idea of what it is that you want to say in the book. And I'm speaking about memoir and nonfiction, because that's kind of my area of expertise, I guess. But I also think, you know, I'm ordinarily I come out of the alternative weekly newspaper magazine world. Now I write a website. And the pieces I write are usually between, you know, 1,000 and maybe 3,000 words. So a book is, you know, my first draft, it was something like 120,000 words. And initially, like that number of words just seemed so daunting that I couldn't imagine putting anything on the page. And so again, like I used that outline and I broke it down and I just thought, okay, you know, this is not a book. This is a series of stories that will proceed in a more or less chronological order toward, you know, from the past toward the present. And I broke it down into chunks, and the book has a lot of chapters. You know, it could have had 10 chapters, but it has many more than that. And that in part is just because my writing practice, it was more effective for me to write it in small chunks and to think of it as small chunks rather than like this mountain that I had to climb. And then eventually, you know, I got to 120,000 words. My editor said, this is way too long. and we ended up cutting about 25,000 words out of it, which was great. And I love that process and I love editors, and thank God for editors. I also am an editor myself, but you know, I can't edit myself. So I was really, really grateful to have this amazing editor who was willing to work with me and just kind of cut mercilessly. But I think the biggest thing is just like, don't think of it as a mountain you have to climb. Think of it as like a series of, you know, discrete plateaus that you have to reach.
I love that. I just wrote a memoir that's coming out this summer and in July. And I did this exact same thing. I was like, I can't do this. It's too long. What am I going to do? And then I was like, I'm going to write a series of scenes, and each scene, I'll just write a scene at a time. And then each scene will link them all together. And anyway.
For me, it was weird. Once I started doing that, it just sort of proceeded like magic. Like,
yeah, me too. It was just boom, boom, boom.
Yeah. And you think it's not going to work, but then it does. And yeah, it was a really amazing process. I mean, it took way longer than anything I'd ever written took, but yeah, it was not, you know, people are often ask like, wasn't it really hard to write a book? And it wasn't any harder than the rest of the writing I do. And once I kind of set myself to it and put myself in the mindset of like not being a news writer, but being a memoir writer, it actually was really, really fun to kind of play with, you know, the way that I wrote and to write in a way that I don't usually, because I'm usually very straightforward, kind of just the facts sort of writer. So I didn't have to do that with this, which is really fun.
Awesome. Well, this is great. I feel like I have someone I like share a brain with in part here. I don't know, so many of the same coping habits. Anyway, it's nice to see it reflected.
Awesome. Yeah, likewise. This has been really fun.
Well, thanks for coming on. And I will think of you as I don't work in the mornings. And I will think of you on Saturdays. And
awesome.
Do it. And yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much. It was great to get to know you.
Thanks, Ivy.
Okay. Take care.
Take care.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram at Zibby Owens and at Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Also sign up for my newsletter at ZibbyOwens.com and sign up for my virtual book club and meet lots of authors on Zoom every other week. Thanks so much to Steve and Ryan at Texture Sound for the sound editing. And thank you to Morning Moon Productions for providing this fantastic intro and outro music.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.